This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 7th of May 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 30th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. On this week's show, you'll be red-faced and out of breath when confronted by our embarrassment of artistic riches. That's the plan, mass blushing. All right, first, we've got a look inside the brand new blockbuster Bauhaus exhibition at the Barbican in London.
I think people forget that actually this, you know, these pieces were made nearly 100 years ago, and it's quite incredible how pioneering their aesthetic and their approach to design particularly was.
The ever-inquiring Andrew Müller will also be investigating the tortured romance of contemporary Eastern European literature. We'll be speaking to a leading writer in the genre and the publisher that puts him into print.
I want to create something, so then I decided, okay, I'm going to set up a publisher, and that's what I'm going to do, because these voices are much neglected on the English-speaking markets.
Culture's producer Katie Bilboa braved the infamous Broadwater Farm estate in Tottenham, North London, for a special screening of La Haine, Matthew Kassovitz's seminal film set in Paris's infamous banlieue.
The only message for us, the positive message, the real big message here is that culture should be, well, the culture is here, it's everywhere.
Plus, a look at the surprising prosperity of Portuguese cinema at the Lisbon Indie Film Festival and a minute of sound from Tokyo. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now then, first we'll have a song before we dip the cultural toe into Bauhaus waters. This is new from Norah Jones from the album called Little Broken Hearts, out last week, and this song is called Say Goodbye. Bauhaus, now house. London's Barbican, that brutalist beauty of multidisciplinary arts that lies between the centre and the city, is playing host to a new exhibition, Bauhaus Art as Life. The show, the most comprehensive on the subject in the UK for 40 years, goes from the art school's foundation by the artist Walter Gropius in 1919 to its dissolution by the Nazis in 1933. The Bauhaus is the byword for classical modernism, and what started as an art school celebrating craft became a powerhouse of utopian intellectual thought and practice, spanning art, architecture, design, typography, theatre, and life as a whole. Bauhaus was indeed a design for life.
What was the Bauhaus? A community of exceptional, visionary, and creative people, both staff and students, who lived and worked and played there together.
Under soft lighting and on gunmetal grey walls on the Barbican's upper level and within purpose-made free-flowing booths on the lower level, the show takes both a chronological and thematic approach. It's not just Marcel Breuer's tubular steel chairs, it's photographs of the lively lot at play too, and some terrifying children's toys. I spoke with the show's curator, Catherine Ince, the day before opening last week.
I think it's had an enormous impact on all areas of artistic practice, visual culture. I think one of the most significant factors has been the preliminary course that was devised there. It was a sort of coming together of ideas and movements in education and creative sort of endeavour. And the preliminary course, really, we understand it as the foundation course that any art student in this country would undertake before going on to specialise in their particular subject area. So I think very directly they've influenced current art school education, but it pervades everything, as you say, from typography through to our love and hate relationship with modernist architecture, particularly in Britain, to furniture. You see some pieces in the show that, although they are the historic objects and they have a sort of patina, they could very clearly have, you know, just come from IKEA, that sort of modular nature of furniture. And I think people forget that actually this, you know, these pieces were made nearly 100 years ago, and it's quite incredible how pioneering their aesthetic and their approach to design particularly was we've got a lot of stage work in the exhibition, particularly about the work of Oscar Schlemmer as the director of the stage between 23 and 29. And his influence has been incredibly powerful, from Lee Bowery to people like Robert Wilson, who we have here coincidentally in the Barbican this week. So, you know, you see these things subtly, but also in a more pronounced fashion. I think people love the Bauhaus for lots of different reasons, and I think that's what makes it so interesting, that people have always something to say or always very responsive to lots and lots of different aspects of the school.
And considering the scope and the reach and the influence of Bauhaus was so far-reaching, so wide, is it tough to put on a show and make sure you've got everything or you're not including too much stuff? I mean, it's every modernist sort of wet dream is a Bauhaus show, right?
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, our exhibition designers and graphic designers were, you know, beside themselves with excitement to tackle the subject. But no, you're right. It's not without an incredible amount of pressure, because it's a very academic subject. It's been explored by experts in the field and other historians for, you know, 90 years. So there's an awful lot of territory that you have to kind of grapple with before you even start to put the show together. But I think we've tried to make it our own exhibition, be very selective within that. There's an awful lot of work that you have the pleasure of choosing from, and we spent a long time just understanding the material, exploring the archives and museums that we were working with and going to be loaning from, and tried to sort of piece together a story that gave you, you know, a comprehensive overview of the diversity of output of the school. But you know, you can never make the definitive exhibition, because you'd have to hire Olympia or something and everybody would be exhausted by the end of it. So I think it's about trying to sort of pull into focus some of those areas that are really familiar to people, that people expect to see. So we've got iconic furniture, decorative art objects, the graphic design. But then we've tried to contrast that with some of the more personal human artifacts that give you a very real sense of the people that made up this art school. And I think that's what we've tried to emphasize. It was a place where people went to study and they lived there and they forged this community. And I think that gets forgotten sometimes, that without all of these people and their kind of curiosity and their drive to experiment and to, you know, live counter probably to the culture of the time, you wouldn't have all of the things that they made. So we've tried to sort of balance this.
Bauhaus seemed to define the modern world as we still think of it. Alma Mahler left the great composer Gustav Mahler to marry Walter Gropius, an architect and the Bauhaus founder. Did this define the difference between an old romantic order and a new practical one?
Things between Gropius and Alma Mahler quickly unraveled. You know, she was a particular creature, and so was he. You know, I think those kind of personal stories that spill over into the professional life of the school. She was very influential, for example, in introducing Johannes Itten to Gropius. They're very indicative of how the professional and the personal intersect, but also give you a kind of impression of the urgency of the time. I think, you know, things were moving at a pace and people were striving to be idealistic in the aftermath of this horrific war. And I think the spirit and the emotion gives one a bit of an insight into what it must have been like at that particular moment in time.
How long does it take to decide what you want and then to put it together? How long has this been in the making?
This has been in the making for several years. You first start having conversations with people about, you know, the possibility of something. Then you spend a long time researching the subject area, looking into collections. There's a long time, you know, you have to have discussions with people, go and see the work that you're interested in borrowing, finding out about whether it's safe to travel, whether the painting or a work on paper or a textile can be shown in the conditions in which we want to show. So there's a lot of practical things that you have to do in order to prepare a show like this, as well as the conceptual development of what it is you're trying to say. It's a very personal thing, because you're asking to borrow very cherished artworks that you have to promise to take care of. It takes a while. And you know, and then of course you've got the book and you're developing the public program and everything that sits alongside. And we try to work here. Exhibition design is very important to us, so we introduce exhibition designers very early stage in the development of the exhibition, because it helps you to visualize how these things will be seen, how they'll be displayed, and for the whole thing to be pulled together. Because I think the environment in which these works sit, or the environment in which you experience the entire exhibition, is really important to add to your understanding of the subject and how things are revealed to you and how you encounter them. So the architects and the graphic designers have felt the weight of history. You know, they want to do a perfect job, and I think they've responded fantastically well.
We are also very happy to see such an intelligent and prudent made exhibition. I think it's really wonderful, and so I hope this exhibition will have a magnificent success. Thank you very much.
The Barbican show was staged with help from the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin, where Kimberly Bradley also had a chat with Sven Beckstretter, editor-in-chief of Text zur Kunst magazine, the authority on art theory in Germany.
Bauhaus was hugely influential a few years ago for contemporary art, not saying maybe because of its interdisciplinarity, but because of the, let's say, utopian vision that was bound to this whole modernist concept. So a lot of artists, let's say 5-10 years ago, they really took a look at Bauhaus, but also at other constructivist movements like De Stijl and Russian constructivism, to take a look what this utopian vision means today. And especially there was one artist from France called Mathieu Mercier. When he came to Germany the very first time, he found it hugely interesting that one huge do-it-yourself chain is called Bauhaus, actually. And so he went there and he was amazed to see all these materials you can buy there. And what he found especially interesting was that the idea of standardization, which actually comes from Bauhaus, you can find it today everywhere, and especially in do-it-yourself stores. So he got all his materials actually from do-it-yourself stores and rebuilt, let's say, iconic pieces of European constructivism. When Bauhaus started, it was a very typical time, a special time in history. You know, you had huge like social problems, you had mass of people living in the cities, and most of these areas were kind of slums. And so the idea of the Bauhaus was, of course, at some point to offer new projects, new visions how these people could have like proper housing. And so they came up with the idea, especially of standardization, because at the same time it happened that there was a standardization also in clothing. So the idea was that everyone could afford a proper clothing, a proper home, and so on. And actually, this is the basic idea of the Bauhaus. And so I wouldn't say that, because we don't have these sorts of changes at the moment, like they were in 1940, I wouldn't say that it would be possible today. The idea actually to have not just its share, but you know that there's some guy behind doing this, and the whole idea of signature design actually comes from the Bauhaus. Of course, it wasn't intended for them that you make a chair and say, well, this is a chair done by this person, because actually at some point it's also a collective.
Sven Beckstretter in Berlin. Before that, I was speaking to Catherine Ince at the Barbican in London. The show, Bauhaus Art as Life, is on until the 12th of August. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're going to watch some films in Lisbon, Portugal, not Ireland, after this.
As the day winds down in Europe, tune in to Midori House at 1800 hours London time for great conversation, fascinating interviews and updates from Monocle editors and correspondents on the road. From authors to designers, artists to directors, some of the world's most creative people slip into Studio One to share their insights, while a Monocle editor or two is always on hand to give their take on the stories of the day. Plus, there's a generous slice of music from Monocle 24's international playlist. That's Midori House at 1800 hours London time every weekday.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now, cinema in Portugal has been suffering in times of austerity, but for the first time in 50 years, it's experiencing something of a revival. Films such as Taboo by Miguel Gomez are seeing record ticket sales in cinemas normally dominated by Hollywood imports, and young directors are receiving prestigious awards internationally, a sign that creativity is still flourishing in times of crisis. Saima Tarek visited a film festival that prides itself on showcasing the best of national film to find out what is behind this resurgence.
There is always a buzz at Indie Lisboa, Portugal's major festival celebrating global independent cinema. Its seventh edition includes screenings of work by indie heavyweights such as Werner Herzog and Ursula Meyer. But this time round also features a record 40 films made in Portugal. According to festival director and programmer Nuna Senna, the financial crisis is seriously affecting the national film industry, particularly considering the current suspension of state funding. However, that does not necessarily mean a dark future for Portuguese cinema.
What will happen is ambitious productions that can be screened in film festivals like Venice, in competition in Venice, in Cannes, or Locarno, or Berlin, will be more scarce than they were this year, last year, 2 years ago. But at the same time, something is happening outside the system. More and more films are being produced. The HD video was, of course, completely absorbed by this young generation of filmmakers. And the do-it-yourself kind of production is also developing in Portugal. It's difficult for these films to compete for the attention and the promotion that the bigger productions get. But there are some nice surprises. I mean, the wonderful film by Gonçalo Tocha, It's the Earth, Not the Moon, something like that in English, was a completely independent production made by the director's own pocket money. He shot during an entire year in this very isolated island in Azores, and the finished version was screened in Locarno, in the filmmakers of the president section, and it took a special mention there. And it's been screened in 30 festivals now. So Ana Terra Nera da Lua is probably the benchmark of this do-it-yourself trend in production in Portugal. I'm really happy with this Portuguese selection because we can see money is always important, of course, but not everything on cinema depends on money.
João Celavisa, a young filmmaker who won the prestigious Golden Bear at Berlin this year for his short Rafa, is part of this new generation. Producing low-budget movies in a country that has a proud history of authorship in storytelling.
What drives me are the questions more connected with individuality rather than subjects or themes. It can be the relationship between a kid and the city, in the case of my last film. It can be the simple idea of having a guy who lives under house arrest to get a bit of sun and to experience some kind of ephemeral experience of freedom. So normally what drives me are very small things, actually. And then the subject and the themes, they come later. I feel proud to be part of a group of directors, older or younger, who always tried to make films under good atmosphere of freedom, aesthetically, formally, economically. There is a period that I'm particular big admirer, which is the 60s, the so-called new Portuguese cinema, the films of Paulo Rocha and Fernando Lopes, António Reis. Of course, in the present, there are other directors that I really admire, of course Pedro Costa, Miguel Gomes, João Pedro Rodrigues, João Canijo. In Portugal there is something very special, which is the fact that all the directors, they have a very particular point of view on the things they film. And sometimes you really don't find many things in common, a part of this idea of making free cinema.
The country's financial troubles are still very much in the minds of filmmakers, even if those troubles are yet to appear in their work. Leonor Noivo, whose feature film was shown at Indie Lisboa, explains.
So my film is Other Letters or The Invented Love. It's about a book that was written in 1972. And this was a project that I had since 2005, so it's like 7 years of project. I waited for a long time to have a financial support for it, and I only had it 2 years ago, so it was a mirror of this situation in Portugal, that you have a project and you have to find support, and then years go by and then, oh no, I have another thinking about the project, so it's like that.
I asked festival director Nuno Senna about his thoughts on the state of Portuguese cinema.
There are some good signs and some bad signs. I mean, there were two major awards given to Portuguese films recently in Berlin Film Festival. The Golden Bear to Rafa and the Alfred Bauer Award to Tabu by Miguel Gomes. Miguel Gomes' film is already the biggest success in terms of international sales of Portuguese cinema. So it's a good year for Portuguese cinema in terms of creativity. It's a terrible year in terms of financially and economically. Commercial distribution is really being monopolized by American productions. I think in Europe, Portuguese has the worst attendance for the national cinema commercially. But at the same time, if you go to a film festival like Vila do Conde, Indie Lisboa, Doc Lisboa, the screenings that attract the more numerous audiences are the Portuguese films. That's the great challenge for the Portuguese cinema, to create the circuit to not disappear from public view. It's not a question of film festivals, it's presence throughout the year on a regular basis when you go to a multiplex or a small independent art house cinema.
I lived basically all my life in the city of Lisbon, so I have a very strong connection with this town. So sometimes I think that I could be my whole life making films about this city, with characters walking and running and getting lost in the streets of Lisbon. Of course, there is some historical heritage that it's very heavy in this country, and the present moment, it's very contradictory and a big contrast to this heritage in all the senses, between classic and some historical past combined with a young generation of people who are totally lost and not knowing what to expect of the future. So I feel a lot excited in a way to film and to make cinema in a moment of big transitions and big changings. So I want to be here to see what's going to happen.
Filmmaker João will start work on his first feature film next year, in anticipation that his peers can do the same. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tarek.
Thank you, Saima. This thing is called Culture with Robert Bound, and it's on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, Andrew Muller will be asking some Balkan questions of both Andrei Nikolaidis and his publisher as they discuss the tortured romance of Eastern European fiction. We'll be going to Tottenham to watch a seminal film about Parisian suburbs, and we'll be off to Tokyo. But just for a minute of sound, that is. Before that little lot, a song. This is Plakete by Zap Mama. It's from a new CD called Adventures in Afrobeat, Volume 1.
Allô, oui, la centrale, taxi vert. Quelle commune, s'il vous plaît?
Ce serait pour...
Quelle commune, s'il vous plaît? 424 VDK en deuxième course. Rogers, la 420 VDK première.
Allô, 424 ici, chargé. À vous.
Bien reçu. Parlez.
That was Plakete by Zap Mama right here on Monocle 24. Hats off to you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in.
Start your Saturdays and Sundays by tuning into the Weekend Edition, Monocle 24's new strand of news, music, interviews and paper reviews, live from Studio One. The Weekend Edition starts on at 8 a.m. London time with a brisk scan of the headlines, international front pages, and then slips into a soundtrack to take you right through to Sunday night. Along the way, there are bulletins at the top of the hour, interviews with our favourite contributors, and a non-stop review of the weekend papers from Melbourne to Montreal as they roll in. The Weekend Edition is delivered direct to your bed, sun lounger or sofa every Saturday and Sunday, right here on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about it. What are these crazy ideas going around in my head?
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions. That's The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 1900 UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Few parts of the world conduct such a glorious and tortured romance with their own literature as Eastern Europe. Hoping to let the English-speaking world in on this is London-based imprint Istros, which specialises in English translations of modern writing from Eastern Europe, with particular reference to the Balkans. One of Istros's authors, Andrei Nikolaidis, is a recent recipient of the European Union Prize for Literature. The Bosnian-born resident of Montenegro is also a journalist and polemicist, frequently embroiled in controversies and feuds, a sort of Balkan Christopher Hitchens. His most recent novel, The Coming, is an apocalyptic detective yarn set in his hometown, Ulcinj. Andrew Miller spoke to Istros director Susan Curtis-Koyakovich and Andrei Nikolaidis.
I wanted to start by asking, first of all, about Istros.
Okay, so it all stems from the fact that I have these strong links with that region, Southeast Europe, that go back about 20 years. And so I've been living on and off and in Slovenia during the war in Bosnia. I lived in Zagreb, just came back from Zagreb, and Romania too. And I was writing as a freelance novelist and also quite involved in the whole literary scene of that area for a while. And then when I knew I was coming back to the UK, I wanted to do something that kind of combined me being here but still linking my whole life and contacts there. So I thought about being an agent, but then I thought, no, because that I want to create something. So then I decided, OK, I'm going to set up a publisher, and that's what I'm going to do, because these voices are much neglected on the English-speaking market. So I wanted to give them a platform.
OK, and Andre, to turn to you now, has the knowledge, I guess, the foreknowledge that your books will be translated into English affected the way you write? Because you don't write in English.
No, of course, I write in Montenegrin. Yesterday, I was answering to a similar question. I think it would be devastating for me as author if I start to calculate about what are my new English-speaking readers are expecting from me. First of all, I don't have a clue. and for a second, I don't really care, to be honest, because I think I would lose the edge. This is the only story I have to tell you. So if it is interesting for you, that's great, of course, and I certainly hope that there will be an interest. But I'm not really that kind of a writer who could easily be adjusted to exceeded or the other expectations.
Your new novel, The Coming, I think, can we call it an apocalyptic detective novel?
Yeah, of course.
Because there's
what it is.
There's a detective and there's an apocalypse, yeah. So that seems fair enough. But I was struck by that set piece which I alluded to earlier, when you have that scene of the men all thinking the world is about to end, and so they all sort of unburden themselves as these great truths, and the next morning obviously can no longer quite look at each other. The line you use is one drop of the truth and this world became impossible. Is that a reflection on what you learnt about upheaval from growing up in the Balkans at the time you grew up?
Absolutely. That's my reflection on what was happening from 1992 to 1996, especially in Bosnia, where I was raised and was forced to leave Bosnia because of Serbian aggression on my country. Well, you know, we were all good neighbors. And one morning, the neighbors becomes executioners. And it was, of course, a traumatic thing to do, to live through. And, of course, that was a moment of my personal apocalypse, you know. Because apocalypse is above all. I mean, what is the meaning of the Greek word apokalypto? That means literally a shifting of the wheel. Showing things as they are.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's what I think that happened in 1992 in former Yugoslavia. We showed to each other who we really are.
Because there's a rumination earlier in the book which tickled me as well, because it rather has tied in with my own personal theory about that war, which I saw a very small amount of, and civil wars I've seen in other places. Your detective character is ruminating on what he calls the primitive man. And the line is, can be gauged by the disturbance he represents for other people, unable to exist in quiet discretion. And what always struck me about the war in Bosnia, for all it was represented as a war of religion or ethnicity, it always struck me as a war between the primitive and the modern. It was the city versus the country.
In a way it was, because Serbian populations was mostly on in villages, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, but of course, they were in Sarajevo too. But first of all, it was, in a way, a civil war. But basically, it was a double aggression from Serbia and from Croatia on the other hand, on Bosnia. And it turned for it, it turned into a civil war. But initially, it was a well-planned aggression. So yeah, it's hard to say what really happened. Even now, you know, it was such a mess.
On the subject of truth telling in that context, though, we should talk a little bit about your other role as a journalist and columnist. And you recently sort of expressed a few truths as you saw it about the 20th anniversary celebrations of Republika Srpska in Banja Luka, which seems to have caused a certain amount of fuss. I think it was, am I right in thinking, the director of Serbia's National Library got fired for supporting you, and Montenegro's president, Filip Vujanović, felt obliged to distance himself from your remarks.
Not first time for him.
do you enjoy that role of the provocateur?
No, not at all. Not at all. But, you know, I'm doing what I... The only thing I can do, you know, that's what I think and that's what I'm writing, you know. And the whole thing was a media spin. A thing never happened. There wasn't any attempt of terrorist attack. The guy that was initially accused was now... They set him free. There is no accusation of terrorism, anything. It was obviously a media spin. And I knew it from the first moment. And that's why I decided to be very sarcastic commenting on that one.
Because this was the remark you made, that you thought it would be a step forward for civilization if rifles and dynamite had been brought into the room where the celebrations were happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is obviously you making a rhetorical point rather than actually inciting violence. Are you still surprised by how tender the sensitivities about that historical period are?
Yeah, but you know what surprises me above any other thing? The way that people reacts... the people in the region reacts violently on irony and sarcasm. That's a real story, you know. I was sentenced to pay 12,000 euros to famous director Emir Kusturica on his... he claimed that I slandered him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in a verdict, judge wrote, I quote, that I am guilty because I was writing about Kusturica and his movies using irony and sarcasm.
It is surprising, though, that irony and sarcasm would get missed in that part of the world, because I've spent enough time there to know that irony and sarcasm are huge undercurrents in the way people respond to things and talk to each other. There's a really lovely sarcastic tone to the discourse in the former Yugoslavia, which I really like.
But sarcasm and irony are really really dangerous to those who are in power, you know, and that's why they react like that.
Okay. And to come back to you again and to come back to Istros, do you have plans to sort of carry on expanding the imprint and looking for new authors in that mm-hmm. part of the world? Do you plan to carry on confining it to
Southeast Europe?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm going to stick within my geographical area of interest. And I'm always on the lookout for new authors. But I have to say that mostly they come to me on recommendations from local agents or publishers. So I usually go directly through them. And I have a number of new authors coming up. Next year, we're probably going to publish a couple of Bosnian titles, one from a female author, other one from a male author, Silvedin Avdic, and a Serbian title, a Macedonian title for the first time, I hope, coming up in the next few years. And then, of course, we have a couple of Romanian titles and a Bulgarian title coming out in September called Nine Rabbits. So I go across the whole region. And I'm going to continue to do that, yeah.
So for all that we were talking earlier about the universality of a good story, do you find that there is something quite discreet and distinctive about the literature of that part of the world?
I think that there's a lot of exciting contemporary voices there. And for some reason, and it's probably to do with the fact that not so many people have the language skills to be able to spot them. And luckily, I do speak, let's call it Serbo-Croatian for argument's sake. So that makes it much easier for me to have direct contact and to see the literature in the original and to make a judgment of it. But there's certainly, especially interesting enough, these kind of new wave of Montenegrin writers, Andrei and also Ognjen Spahić, who's coming to the UK for the European Literature Night at the British Library in May. And there's others, I'm sure Andre would be happy to tell you. Particularly, for some reason, there seems to have been a kind of flowering of literature in Montenegro after a period, I believe, of kind of nothing much coming out of it since before the war. So I think that's pretty exciting.
And Andre, is there even a vague worry, I guess, for somebody whose entire style or certainly journalistic career has been based on being very uncompromising and quite provocative and always willing to engage in arguments and goad his countrymen into facing up to things, etc., that if further sort of international recognition, you know, comes your way, you might start feeling obliged to act as an ambassador for Montenegro rather than a truth teller to it?
I don't think so. You mentioned that the president of Montenegro is not really a fan of mine, so I don't have to think about it.
I don't think it's going to be a problem either somehow. Andre and Susie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Andrew Muller speaking to ISTROS director Susan Curtis-Koyakovich and Andriy Nikolaidis. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. La Haine is Mathieu Kassovitz's seminal 1995 film about a gang from the Parisian banlieue. Following a single day in the life of three young guys from immigrant families and their perennial existence on the edge of society and the edge of violence. The film played in the Social Centre in North London's infamous Broadwater housing estate last week in order to shine a light on urban social problems, explore ethnic tensions and hopefully to entertain the residents too. Katie Bilboa went along to take the temperature in Tottenham.
We're in a place where two riots have basically taken place within the last 30 years. This night happening is incredible. It's been an incredible night.
Folks live in tower blocks for 20 years, but they don't know their neighbours. They don't share knowledge or love. They'd rather act like strangers.
The Broadwater Farm Estate in Tottenham, North London, towers above the allotments and Victorian terraces that surround it. Its 1960s Le Corbusier-inspired buildings are balanced on the tips of upturned concrete triangles with cars perching underneath. They look like a dated spaceship that landed in the heydays of sci-fi. 30 years ago, this was the kind of place you wouldn't want to go near at night. But this evening, the community centre nestled in the middle of the estate has come alive. Tonight is the culmination of weeks of work. It's the opening night of a project called Outreach Films. 400 local residents are watching a screening of the French 1990s masterpiece La Haine. It's accompanied by a booming live soundtrack from British electronica band Asian Dub Foundation. Around them, graffiti artists aloft on scaffold towers paint images on stretched canvases. Breakdancers spin effortlessly to French hip-hop, and a local boxer, just turned professional, dances for hours around a dangling leather punch bag. Fabien Regal is the founder and creative director of Future Cinema. They've been working with the local community to stage the event.
The Other Cinema is a community-based project to build a network of other cinemas around the world where people can essentially set up a screen in their local place and we join them up all together as one. The Other Cinema. So one cinema, thousands of screens around the world, and what we want to do is bridge different communities and cultures together to watch films and get involved and make films. And so for us, screening La Haine here in Broadwater Farm, we see it as a really powerful idea.
Welcome to Broadwater Farm. If you could take your seats, please, that would be really helpful.
Broadwater Farm became infamous in the 1980s when it was the scene of riots which culminated in the death of British policeman Keith Blakelock. In the decades that followed, millions of pounds of investment in redesign and community projects led to a dramatic decrease in crime across the estate. But the area is not without its problems. Just down the road in central Tottenham, a peaceful protest last summer ended in violent riots which spread across all corners of London. Isaac Dentsu is one of the co-founders of Outreach Films. He thinks there are definite parallels between his community and the Parisian suburbs portrayed in La Haine.
I think there's definitely a similarity in the broken relationship between the community and the establishment that's represented in the film to be the police. there's definitely a synergy there, and that's why we screened it. We need to find a new way of kind of voicing our opinion to them.
And do you think showing the film tonight is part of that process?
Yes, definitely, because the film ends on Hubert. It ends on Hubert's look, which is a powerful look, because he's just seen his friend being murdered, seeing he's basically been on a rampage because one of his friends before that have been killed by the police. So essentially you see his look and it's what's next. What does he do? Pick up a gun and now get retaliation for all three? What's next? And you just see this blank expression where he closes his eyes real tight. And I mean, I feel that's the climate we're currently in. So hopefully that will inspire us. Seeing that mirror image will inspire us to think about it and try to articulate ours in more of a meaningful way.
Et alors? J'ai pas le temps. C'est quoi la réponse?
Mais j'ai pas de réponse, je sais pas. Ok, d'accord, je sais jamais.
So how have you two been working together? How has this relationship worked?
So basically this relationship's worked like this. I tell him what to do and he does it. That's the beauty of it. What goes up must come down.
On the roundabout that you must go round. That's right, mate. That's right. How about I take the food and you get no money? And we both go our own separate ways.
Today ain't your lucky day, fam. You're a dead man.
The project also includes screenings of three short films made by local directors and a Mike Skinner of Streets fame music video. It's not just a UK venture, as Fabian explains.
Tonight there was four other screenings, one in Estonia, one in Bournemouth, and I think there was another one as well on the same night. But essentially it launched here at Broadwater Farm and it's going to Paris on the 5th. On the eve of the presidential election. The only message for us, the positive message, the real big message here is that culture should be, well, the culture is here, it's everywhere.
But the problem with it, it's segregated at the moment, and we need to get it in a melting pot where it all really melts together and becomes this lovely thing called life in its truest form.
I'm very happy with what happened, but the fact that it may be a little message to say, you know, that community and communities sharing ideas, you know, that for me is the most positive thing to come out of this.
It's probably more than a coincidence that the London and Paris screenings are both timed to happen in deprived areas on the eve of an election. And while political leaders search for ways to appease voters and quell political unrest, there's definitely something to be said for making something small but effective happen as a team at a local level. For Monocle, in Tottenham, North London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
Now for a drop of Japan. Our man in the middle of all that glowing neon and all those demure izakaya went out with a mic into the night to capture the sound of the streets. Here are his results in this week's 1 minute of sound. Thank you, Kenji. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Band. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and this show was mixed by Bringing Home the Bacon, James D. Bacon. Time for one final song this week. This is Lazuli New from Beach House. Thanks for tuning in.